Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you for the invitation. I'm honoured to be here. I'm delighted to be here, actually, and have already in my still unfortunately short visit to South Africa had a whole range of interesting conversations with mostly social scientists, since I'm a sociologist by trade, but also more broadly with people in the intellectual world here. I've offered a rather ambitious topic for this lecture, and I realised to my dismay after offering it and after it had been set in stone that the topic rather suggested that I was a high-tech person who would be giving you lots of fascinating detail about new online technologies, about the innards of the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. What is a Large Hadron, anyway? And such like things. I'm not a high-tech person at all, though I will be talking a little bit about technology, because you can't really come to terms with the, you know, world of contemporary intellectuals without doing that. In fact, we can't come to terms with contemporary intellectual life without paying attention to quite a lot of sources of change in our lives and work. About 10 years ago, I did a survey of intellectual workers in Australia. We had a sample of 500. It was a national survey. It was not only academics, it was also intellectual workers in government, in the corporate sector, and in NGOs and private employment. So across that spectrum of institutions and forms of intellectual work, one of the questions we asked was, would you say that in your field of work, concepts and methods are changing rapidly, not rapidly, not at all, you know, the kind of question that you ask in a poll-type situation. And 83% of them, and pretty much regardless of the sector they were working in, said yes, methods and concepts are changing rapidly in my field. And we also did sort of close face-to-face, close-up interviews with a smaller sample of intellectual workers, getting life history interviews, which is a research technology that I use a lot. And it seemed to me out of that that this survey result was probably right, that when intellectual workers talked personally and intimately about their workplace and their life experience, there were indeed lots of narratives of quite dramatic change. So I have become concerned that we need to map the changes, to get some kind of grip on their meaning for intellectual work itself and not just the external circumstances of intellectuals' lives. Well, I want to begin that reckoning with what we might think of as the traditional account of what an intellectual is or who an intellectual is, an account that I call to myself the tale of the intellectuals, or perhaps better understood, the legend of the intellectuals, or in Australian Indigenous terms, perhaps we might call it intellectual dreaming. According to this tale, an intellectual inhabits the left bank in Paris and inhabits the left wing in politics and smokes Gauloises cigarettes and writes dense and unintelligible books in cafes pushing the boundaries of philosophy and literature and so on and so forth. Okay, you know this image, I'm sure. Well, there is, in fact, one person that it more or less matches. Here he is. This is Jean-Paul Sartre, around whom a wonderful myth of the engaged intellectual accumulated and who became undoubtedly an international role model for progressive intellectuals. And he did all of those things, including smoking the Gauloises. This image of the, I'm caricaturing, of course, but this image of the intellectual is not a trivial ideal of what it might be to be an intellectual, someone who is deeply engaged in philosophical problems or problems about knowledge, has integrity, has commitment, and is willing, in the famous phrase, to speak truth to power. I think that is a powerful and valuable image of the intellectual, even if, as I'm going to argue, it is now in certain ways unrealistic. But that image does have a history, and it's worth recognising that history. The word intellectual itself was invented at a particular moment of history, about 100, 110 years ago. It was invented in France. It was in the context of a huge political dispute that convulsed French society and culture around the turn of the 19th to the 20th centuries. And that dispute concerned an army officer called Dreyfus. Many of you, I'm sure, will know the story of the Dreyfus affair, which was involved struggles over the future of the French state, struggles over religion, class, and so on. But a crucial moment in that conflict was a declaration by a very famous writer, Émile Zola, who published this letter, J'accuse, I accuse, addressed to the President of the Republic, in which Zola set out, in fact, the truth of the case that this particular army officer had been railroaded in order to conceal the corruption of a clique of establishment officers who were connected with the political right and so on and so forth. And that struggle was carried forward by an organisation called the League of the Rights of Man, which became the centre of a discussion about intellectuals and their role in politics. Here was an intellectual, a group of intellectuals, in fact, very decidedly speaking truth to power and telling the powerful what was what and what they had to do. And in that moment, I guess, a kind of self-image of the intellectual was formed, in which the intellectual was the bearer of claims for justice, but also of a kind of modernity being asserted against the backward-looking outlook of the establishment which had oppressed Dreyfus. Now, that image of the intellectual didn't remain static. It has, in fact, evolved somewhat through the 20th century, and it's evolved in a series of debates about the nature of modernity, the nature of politics, the role of ideas and organised knowledge in politics and social change. And indeed, some very famous figures, not only of the academic world but also of the political world, have been leading figures in that debate about intellectuals. Lenin, for instance, with his theory of the party as basically an organisation of intellectuals giving direction to a revolutionary working class. Antonio Gramsci, a better intellectual than Lenin, and the author of fascinating analyses of intellectuals, organic intellectuals, as he called them, in contrast with traditional intellectuals, in his analyses of social formations, backwardness, social change and revolution in Italy. Karl Mannheim, one of the great European sociologists of the 20th century, more or less invented the modern sociology of knowledge, did so around a conception of the intellectual as the bearer of knowledge and the possibility of what he called a scientific politics, by which he meant a scientifically informed democratic politics. Michel Foucault, who famously turned many of these arguments on their head with his concept of power knowledge, pouvoir savoir, the fusion of knowledge and control in discourses which passed for sciences. Alvin Gouldner, the American sociologist who developed the concept of a new class out of these debates about intellectuals and saw the growth of the university system as an important social shift. Zygmunt Bauman, another very famous contemporary sociologist, a postmodernist who again tried to reverse the story of intellectuals by suggesting the problems in intellectuals taking a role of, as he put it, legislators saying the way the world should go. So we have debates about political vanguards, about new classes, and so on. And there are many different positions in these debates, but all of them more or less grow out of this notion of the intellectual as a bearer of modernity, capable of intervention in political spaces, and all of them say something nice to intellectuals, whether they're agreeing or disagreeing with the kind of thesis of speaking truth to power. They all tell us that intellectuals matter. We count for something in the world, is the kind of subtext of this whole debate. Okay, that's, if you like, the starting point of my reflections tonight. The tale of the intellectuals, what we can now perhaps regard as a more or less traditional account of what it is to be an intellectual and what our significance in the world might be. And for the next few minutes, I want to make two corrections to that story. Suggest there are two major ways in which that story has to be revised and rethought if we're to understand the realities of intellectual life and work now. The first of these corrections is to invite you to think carefully about the nature of intellectual work as work. That is, to think of what intellectuals do as a form of labour, which in many ways resembles other forms of labour, to think of intellectuals, in fact, as a workforce with workplaces and industrial relations and hierarchies and forms of management and resistance, much as we might say for any other form of labour and any other group of workers. The picture I've put up here is, to my mind, a very interesting one because it marks a certain transition in intellectual labour. Zola, the author of the famous letter I Accuse, could sit at home with a pen in his hand and produce a novel. In fact, he produced 100 or so. a bit of a rate buster, our friend Zola. What we're looking at here is the social science building at the University of Chicago that was erected in the early 20th century, I think in the 1920s, with money from Rockefeller, oil money. Rockefeller, like many other American capitalists of the day, was worried about the social turbulence and, to use a more recent term, ungovernability of American society in the early 20th century after generations of predatory capitalism, ungoverned expansion across the North American continent, and a lot of violence. So one of the things that the Rockefellers did was put money into social science research, on the idea that funding universities to do social science, to study the cities, study the poor, study the workers, study the ethnic groups, that they would come up with means of social control, that they would feed into the policing function, to the social welfare mechanisms and the like. And this was turned into a concrete program of research, at the University of Chicago. This was the most famous sociology school in the world at the time. It's still an important moment in the history of sociology, the famous Chicago School. And I'm not sure if you can read any of this from the auditorium, but this is a list of the research projects that they undertook with the Rockefeller money. So this was a kind of social research agenda undertaken on an institutionalized basis with corporate funding and with the agreement and cooperation of the local state, because they worked in with the Chicago Police Department, with the social welfare authorities, and so forth. And a famous series of studies, seriously famous in sociology, that were an important contribution to the making of the modern social sciences, developing methods, for instance. So this is an important early example of what later became a very familiar feature of the realm of organized knowledge, that is, the research institute operating between the corporate world and the state with backing from universities. That is now an extremely familiar model of the production and circulation and use of knowledge. Well, I don't want to go on about Chicago, the particular Chicago case. There are many others that that you will know. But I do want to emphasise what's, in a way, dramatised here, that the production of knowledge is now in itself a bit industrialised. It's a collective endeavour. It's not just someone sitting down with a pen and memories and evolving some kind of statement out of their own inner consciousness. It's now a collectivised, organised, somewhat bureaucratised labour process. And this was made rather forcibly, this point was made rather forcibly to me in our own interviews with Australian intellectual workers in the course of the project that I mentioned, when one of them reflected on her own early experience as a research assistant and research associate in a funded, corporate-funded research program in a leading Australian university, my own, in fact. She looked back with a certain bitterness about her role as a cog in the knowledge production business and said, you know, really, a well-trained monkey could have done this work. Well, that was a biochemist with a PhD. And it was a bit bitter, but it was making the point of the routinisation and collectivisation of a great deal of knowledge production. And that is now fairly characteristic of life in universities around the world. We have a jointly produced curriculum. We don't produce our courses in isolation. We do it in a departmental level in relation to departments in other universities and so on. We are managed by a cadre of academic administrators. We now do our work in the presence of performance indicators. We collectivise the assessment of knowledge. Every year I give a seminar, a workshop, in fact, on academic writing to students in my institution, in the course of which I try to explain to them blind refereeing in academic journals, which is a concept students find very hard to grasp until they get the point that this is a collective mechanism of quality control in the shared institutionalized project of producing, assessing and circulating knowledge. So it's against that background, which goes back into history a significant distance, that we should think about the contemporary technologisation of intellectual labour. But this has gone far and fast. In that survey about 10 years ago, we asked people how regularly they used certain pieces of equipment. And 94% of them said that they were regular users of a personal computer, and that was 10 years ago. 89% of them said that they were regular users of email. 73% said they were regular users of the internet. And I'm sure all of those percentages are approaching 100% now. You can't actually work in a university now without being on a computer a fair bit of the time, at least working as an academic. And it's not just in universities. Let me read you a little passage from a person who is an intellectual worker in a corporate context, a corporate strategist called Rachel, unusually a woman in the managerial context. Here she goes. "I'm linked every which way you possibly can. Fax, internet, email, and I'll do a lot at home. Technology plays a very big part of my job. I'm an absolute news hound. I love getting up. I mean, I get up at 5 o'clock every day because I'm an early morning person. I hit the internet, I read the Financial Times," she means London, "and the Sydney Morning Herald," our equivalent for Cape Times, "and CNN from the United States, and get the world news, and I love it. It's at my fingertips." And that is absolutely characteristic of managers. I'm also doing research on managers for another project, and that is very characteristic of the lives of corporate managers as well as academics. Now, I won't go into this in great depth, but I do want to put forward the idea that this is not just a technical shift in how we write our papers, that we do it now on a word processing program rather than clicking away on a typewriter or even scratching it up with a pen. The growth of these technologies has, I think, in significant ways changed the nature of scholarship. The fact is that many researchers, for instance, in the biological sciences, do much of their research out of data banks, not actually mucking around in a wet lab themselves. Even I, in the social sciences, not at risk of working in a laboratory, nevertheless rely now very greatly on internet searches for bibliographical purposes. And this has changed the meaning of memory for scholarship. So when I began work in the university all those years ago, being a scholar meant you had read personally a whole stack of stuff about your subject, you'd been through the documents, you'd browsed the relevant bits of the library, you read all the books and all the recent papers that there were, and you had all that in your memory, maybe on cards and bits of paper, but basically it was in your memory. No one needs that use of memory now. In fact, it'd be highly inefficient when all of that stuff is there in the databases. What you need to remember now is how you find it. You need methodological memory rather than the stack of information itself. So scholarship is shifted. I mean, it's not been totally revolutionised, of course, but it is shifted by these kinds of changes. Okay, that's my first correction, that we need to think of intellectual work, as collectivised, and therefore as subject to technological and social change. The second correction that I want to make to our tale of the intellectuals is relates to my title. And this is, that is a European story. It's even almost a Parisian story. It's not a story about the world. There is a hugely more complex, diverse and interesting history of intellectuals than that single European story would suggest. If we look across the world before the advent of European-centred imperialism, We find many different formations of intellectual work and intellectual life in many different cultures. Think, for instance, of Confucian China and the Mandarin class, a class of scholars centred on a very elaborate and sophisticated literary culture, which was actually interwoven with the Chinese system of government, so that the idea that an intellectual spoke truth to power would make very little sense in Neo-Confucian culture, because the intellectual was the power holder, in a way. That was the way the Chinese state was organised. Or think of the Islamic world, formation of intellectual labour that is called the ulama, the Islamic scholars, bearers of Islamic jurisprudence, knowledge about the Islamic scriptures, the hadith, the traditional stories, as well as the texts, who played a very important role in the lives of Muslim societies, did on occasion speak truth to power, and weren't the only possible group of intellectuals, as reflection on the Sufi intellectuals would indicate. Or think closer to home of the poets, the artists, and the technologists of pre-colonial Africa, and you will see that there are indeed radically diverse histories of intellectuals on a world scale. Then imperialism changes the world, and new groups or types of intellectuals emerge. Some of them are the intellectuals of the colonising cultures and colonising populations. Think, for instance, of Thomas Jefferson, a Creole intellectual, an intellectual of considerable importance in modernity. Think of José Martí in Cuba, the poet and driver of revolution in Cuba. Think in Australia of someone like Henry and Louisa Lawson, son and mother. She, an important feminist intellectual, he a central figure in the history of Australian literature. And think of novelists from Patrick White in Australia to Coetzee in South Africa. We have, again, a whole formation of intellectuals growing up in the circumstances of settler colonialism with different different histories and different roles in the world from those of Europe. And then think, and this is a wider scene now, of the critical modernisers, the intellectuals of the colonised cultures and communities who made an intellectual response to colonisation. I'm thinking here of people like Al-Afghani, a contemporary of Marx and Engels, as it happened, and perhaps an equally important intellectual figure, though not one well known in the canon of European-derived academic culture, but a crucial figure in the Islamic world's response to colonisation, imperial power, and the impact of Western technologies and government. Think of someone like Kartini, again, not well known in the Anglophone world, immensely important in the cultural history of Indonesia, a colonial feminist, a woman who developed a critique of the subordination of women in Javanese culture, attempted to use the resources of the Dutch colonial state without very much success, but triggered a kind of educational and gender radicalism in the history of Indonesia, and became a very important figure in the history of Indonesian nationalism. And I could go on. Figures you will know well in this country, Sol Plaatje, who's, I think, should be regarded as a very important figure in the history of world sociology, though he doesn't yet figure in most of the textbooks. Fanon and Krumer and so on. Okay, again, a different genealogy, a different place in the world, but also major intellectual figures who should be part of our understanding of what it is to be an intellectual. Now, when we take the global point of view, when we begin to get our bearings in this very much wider history of intellectuals, we put that together with the point about intellectual labour, and we begin to think of intellectual work as having a global dimension, as being an industry, if you like, organised on a global scale. We are sort of collective producers of knowledge, and that collective isn't only organised locally. It has a global organisation. We can look back into the history of modern science and see this very clearly in the lives of figures as familiar as Charles Darwin, who in the early part of his life went out into the colonised world and collected data about biology, geology and so on and so forth, brought it back to England, and 20 years later out popped the theory of evolution, to put it briefly. Well, he was only one of hundreds of collectors and thousands of members of the colonising communities, military officers, missionaries and colonial governors, travelling professionals and so on and so forth, who sent back data from the natural sciences about colonised societies, about exotic customs and so forth, to the metropole, where they played a very important part in the creation of 19th century sciences, natural sciences like biology, social sciences like sociology, for instance, which, contrary to our own disciplinary myth in sociology, was actually very much involved in its early stages with the colonised world and drew a great deal on the information that came back from the frontier of colonial conquest. Now, I've learned a lot in trying to think about these issues from the Beninese philosopher Pauline Huntongi, who, in work extending over 30 years or so, has gradually developed what I think of — he wouldn't, he's a philosopher — but what I think of as a kind of global political economy of knowledge, an understanding of the way of the nature of the global trade in knowledge, where he makes a fundamental distinction between the basic roles played by the global metropole, the rich, capital-intensive countries of the global north, the former imperial powers, and the colonised majority world, the global periphery, in which he argues that the periphery has played the role in the evolution of modern science of a data mine. This is where a great deal of the data for modern science was collected. But the global metropole, the imperial centre, became the place where theory was developed, where that data was organised and thought through and theoretical knowledge was produced, which was then re-exported to the periphery, essentially in the form of applied science. Technology, agricultural science, social administration techniques, psychology, and so on and so forth. Now, that seems to me a fairly good sort of core model of the way the global trade in knowledge has worked historically. And again, it's something that I have picked up in my own research in Australia. Because Australia is, although it's a rich country, is also very much a part of the global periphery. It's a primary exporting economy, it's culturally dependent, it's the product of settler colonialism. And our intellectual life in Australia operates very much in the way Huntongi suggests, that we as intellectual workers in the periphery are what he calls extroverted, that is, oriented to sources of intellectual authority outside our own society, i.e. located in the global metropole. So here is a short extract from an interview with a chemist in an Australian university, talking about his relations with the rest of the world. In this project, we were interested in the kinds of connections that Australian intellectuals had with the rest of the world. Okay, but listen to the list of countries he mentions, and we didn't cue any of this. This was all a spontaneous statement. Well, he says there's no formal structure, but quite a close-knit relation between chemistry departments in Australia and in the UK and United States and Canada and New Zealand, for that matter, but also to a lesser extent, but still nevertheless quite useful, with quite a few of the European countries, like France and Germany in particular, and Holland. There's like a network, an exchange of information about all aspects of chemistry education. And of course, a lot of these people linked each other, international conferences, which is clearly an important part of it. Get the list? Okay, nothing in Asia, nothing in Africa, nothing in Latin America. It's all the global metropole that... And we're on the other side of the world. I mean, all those other regions are closer. But it's the global metropole that is the source of authority in his discipline, where people are sent for training, for postdoctoral work, where they like to publish, and so on. This is an attitude, well, Hintonji calls it extraversion, but a famous Australian literary critic had a sharper name for it, the cultural cringe. Okay, that's history, if you like. That's the situation that contemporary academic workers in Australia come out of, and indeed most intellectual workers outside the universities as well. And of course there are other forms of knowledge. There is, you know, there are marginalised forms of Indigenous knowledge that come out of Aboriginal communities in Australia. There are alternative knowledge forms that you find in subcultures. There's activist knowledge that's associated with social movements like countercultures and the environmental movement and so forth. But it's very difficult. The way the global knowledge industry is organised, it is difficult to sustain those alternatives as alternatives. And I'll take the time to tell just one brief story from my own recent experience about this. A year and a half ago, I spent a little time at the Chinese University of Hong Kong giving lectures and doing workshops in capacity development around gender issues, which is one of my fields of specialisation. The Chinese University of Hong Kong had been founded back in the 1950s by Chinese intellectuals who had fled from the 1949 revolution, from the civil war in China, fled the communists, and washed up in the British colony of Hong Kong. And there they had set up institutions which eventually merged to be the Chinese University of Hong Kong to preserve the traditional Chinese intellectual culture of which they were the bearers. And this was in conscious contrast to the University of Hong Kong, which was the British colonial university that had been set up and which did its teaching in English and had an English-based curriculum and so forth. So the Chinese University of Hong Kong insisted that its teaching would be in Chinese, and its curriculum reflected a lot of the traditional Confucian culture. A few years before I went there, about, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, the governing council of the Chinese University of Hong Kong decreed that henceforth teaching in this university would be in English. There were student riots. They occupied the Senate room. There were strikes by the academics. There were protests in the newspapers. It was great upheaval. But nevertheless, it went through. And indeed, I wouldn't have been there otherwise because I speak no word of Chinese. The reasoning, the rationale for it, was that only by teaching in English would that university be able to hold a competitive position in the global economy of knowledge, to be ranked in the Times Higher Education Supplement ranking of world universities, to attract overseas students who would get a qualification that would work in global markets. All of this kind of logic conspired to break down, you know, that institution's original mission of preserving traditional Chinese intellectual culture. So it's a tough thing to go against this transnational formation. I want to, in the last few minutes of this talk, to reflect on things that are happening currently and on the possibility of alternatives. That story about China is relevant because one of the important things that has happened in the realm of the production of knowledge is what we might call the massification of the world university system. In my lifetime, the number of universities in Australia has gone from, I think it was 6, to about 30, and the size of each of them has grown perhaps tenfold. So we now have a mass higher education system where before there were tiny elitist finishing schools for the children of the rich. And that kind of thing has happened on a world scale. China is the most dramatic current example because the Chinese regime is currently investing heavily in a higher education system, closely modelled, much of it, on American higher education. I think they could have done better than that, but anyway, that's the way they've gone. But this is all, you know, part of a larger process, the great educational revolution of the last 60 years, which has produced enormous growth in literacy, school attendance rate, the massification of the education system worldwide. And the growth of an African university system is part of this story. Though I was interested to read, when I came to read about African universities, that here, as in the story about the Chinese University of Hong Kong, the great majority of African universities teach in a language which is not the language of the majority of the people in their country. So the transnational language, the language of imperialism, English, is now the international currency. And that itself is connected with other social changes, so that the growth of a mass higher education system worldwide is part of the creation of a transnational middle class with international careers in a newly expanded transnational economy. So this has created the possibility for international careers for particular kinds of academic or intellectual workers. We think of people like, for instance, Amartya Sen as a benign example of this, and there are many less benign. It's meant the creation of world audiences for bodies of knowledge, for disciplines, and sometimes for individual writers like Sen, on a scale that has never existed before. So there is something, you know, radically new out there in terms of the audience and the scale of organised intellectual work. But it's also relevant that this has occurred at a time of the neoliberal transformation of the global economy, the growth of a free market agenda in political systems around the world, the integration of national markets, the creation of enormous international financial markets. All of this impacts on the organisation of knowledge too. We now have what is sometimes called in Australia the enterprise university as a model of what a university might be, competing with that older idea of the public service university. Within universities, even those which remain are working on a public service model, we have neoliberal techniques of management, performance management, for instance, which has been introduced in my university to a certain amount of angst. We have lots of competitive assessment of individuals universities, departments. And this is connected with what I've been saying. Here is the ISI ranking of the top 20 international journals in my discipline, sociology. And again, I don't know if you can read the names, so I'll read a couple of them from the top. American Sociological Review, number one. American Journal of Sociology, Annual Review of Sociology, also American. Social Networks, American. Sociology of Health and Illness, American. Journal of Marriage and the Family, American. A good journal. Sociological Method and Research, American. Social Problems, another very good journal, also American. Are you getting the picture? British Journal of Sociology, huh? And then back to the Americans. It's all the global metropole. It's all Anglophone. It's no surprise that the ISI rankings are produced in the United States. But that's currency now. That matters. That affects promotion prospects, grants, infrastructure, money from governments and so on is now tied to this kind of mechanism. So neoliberalism matters for knowledge production, and it does have some paradoxical and strange effects. For instance, the performance management of academics is focused on the idea of individual performance. I mean, we have individual performance indicators and goals and so on and so forth. But that, in a way, radically contradicts all that I've been saying about the collectivization of the production of knowledge. I produce knowledge, certainly, you know, I'm active in it, but very largely as a member of teams. And it is a bit illogical, in fact, then, to try to manage me as if I was a corporation in my own right in competing with the people whom I'm actually cooperating with in producing knowledge. And, you know, the paradox here is that what's intended as an objective measure of the quality or significance of the work associated with a particular journal, in fact, turns into a cultural mechanism of dominance of a particular version of academic life in the social sciences, that is, the dominant version in the United States. So there are very troubling effects. Even more troubling when we go into fields like biomedical science and see the direct impact of corporate funding on the publication of research results in medical journals, something which is now very much troubling the journals themselves. We are in, you know, in a moment where there is, I think, considerable turbulence about the way the Republic of Knowledge, if you like, should organise itself and relate to corporate and state power. Okay, this is in some ways a fairly grim picture that I'm painting, and I've paint this picture with a certain amount of pain because I went into academic life hoping to do something very different than competing on a rating scale with my colleagues for brownie points in a performance management system. I thought I was doing something very different from that. But there are other possibilities there. They are marginalised, but they are there. And I want to spend a couple of moments now sketching a couple of these possibilities. One is that the hegemony of the global north and the rich and powerful institutions of Europe and North America can be contested, and indeed is being contested. One nice example of that is a young German sociologist, Wiebke Keim, who's recently published this book, which translates into English as Audacious Disciplines, in which he came to South Africa and looked at the way sociology, and specifically industrial sociology, had developed in Southern Africa, and argued that it did in fact have a different construction of knowledge from industrial sociology in the global north, much more closely related to democratic social movements, and offering what she called a counter-hegemonic possibility for the development of that field of social science. I've been involved in something, the same kind of exercise, looking at knowledge production from the global south and trying to think how that might, how the production of knowledge in different parts of the global south might connect in an agenda for the reconstruction of social science on a world scale. It's very early days in this kind of endeavour, but nevertheless it is a concrete possibility that is now attracting attention and work. Oops, sorry, I've gone the wrong way. Finally, I want to say that out of the global south, out of anti-colonial struggles and struggles against neocolonialism, have come other images of the intellectual, other imaginations of what intellectual life might be. Not always, you know, light years away from that traditional tale of the intellectuals I began with, but often drawing in other cultural resources. One of these is due to this man, the late Ali Shariati, a very important intellectual in the modern history of Iran. A person who was said at the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979 to be as influential a figure as the Ayatollah Khomeini in terms of the consciousness of the people in the street struggling to overthrow the dictatorship, the neo-colonial dictatorship that ruled Iran at the time. A radical sociologist and theologian who tried to find in Islam the basis for new forms of intellectual work and new ways of grappling with using and transforming knowledges from the West, which had so much preoccupied Islamic intellectuals going back to al-Afghani, whom I mentioned before. Shariati, among his other efforts, produced a very interesting sociology of intellectuals, one part of which was his suggesting a model for intellectual life, which he called, you'll have to forgive my Farsi pronunciation because I don't have any, he called Rushan Fekr, a word meaning something that was not a traditional intellectual like the ulama, not a power holder, but someone who mediated between Islamic culture, modern circumstances, and popular audiences, who played a role in articulating possible directions for the society and feeding knowledge back to to a popular audience. An interesting sort of inflection of the idea of what an intellectual might be. And I'm going to leave you with that idea to think upon, with just one amendment to Shariati's own thought, and that is, this can't really be done on an individual basis. If we take what I have been saying about the importance of collective, shared processes of the production of knowledge, finding new ways for intellectuals to work and relate to wider audiences must also be a collective process rather than something that produces just individual stars. I think this is actually a hard time to be an intellectual. I think young people coming into intellectual work at this point do face difficult times in mapping out, in forging ways to be an intellectual that would be satisfying, technically good, if you like, and ethically and politically worthwhile. But I do think it is possible. I think there are potential new models, such as the one I've just been mentioning, and therefore I think I'm happy to, like to work with young people and think there are fruitful paths for intellectual workers into the future. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Robert Morrell will give the formal vote of thanks after the answer, the question and answer session, but I just want to jump in here to say that I know that you'll agree with me that we've had a wonderfully informative and stimulating analysis of intellectuals of extraordinary range, and I think you'll also agree with me that we've seen demonstrated Professor Cornell's legendary ability to communicate. So thank you very much for a wonderful lecture. We will now have a short question and answer session of about 10 minutes, and so the floor is open. If you stand at the mic.
I get the mic, you don't.
Do we have a roving mic as well? Yes, we do.
Indeed, sorry. Very good.
Who will ask the first question? Over there.
Thanks.
Please keep it short.
Okay. I'll try. I think the title was misleading, Intellectuals in the 21st Century, and the reason for that is because I was expecting a talk that would talk, that would raise issues around intellectuals within and outside institutions. But I realized that you were concentrating on sociology of knowledge within universities, and that you are advocating for the change of knowledge of knowledge production within kind of institutions, academic institutions. Where does that leave intellectual work outside universities or outside formal institutions, like your civil society, like your community-based organizations and stuff like that?
Yes, I guess it's true that I've mainly taken the academic world as my point of reference, my own, of course, my own occupational circumstance. And here I would, I defer to your knowledge about the way non-university knowledge production works in Africa, but I can speak about the way this works in Australia, where production of knowledge in, for instance, NGOs and the corporate world is actually strongly dependent on the university system, so that people who, for instance, conduct social research in an NGO context or a social movement context, who would, for instance, work for the trade union movement, or who would work for NGOs in the welfare sector, are all, without exception, trained in universities, use research technologies that they have learnt in universities, and will look to people in the universities for quality control, validation of what they're doing, even when they're taking the results of their work to a non-academic audience. And for that reason, I guess, I've been willing to focus the core of my argument on the dynamics within the university, because that determines to a very large extent the possibilities of knowledge production in other contexts. Now, that may be different in Africa, and I'd be interested to hear people's opinions, but I know that some people who have written about intellectual work in Africa, and I'm thinking, for instance, of Tandeka Makandawire and his book, African Intellectuals, points to NGOs as a major source of funding for social research, but not functioning as an autonomous form of the production of significant forms of knowledge. In fact, in his account, that is produced, that funding mechanism tends to produce short-term, practically oriented and untheorized forms of social knowledge. Again, this is not an area that I know, and I'd be very interested to know if other people had another perspective on this.
Sorry. I sort of partly want to respond to that question, is that we stuck with a situation where knowledge is validated and defined in particular ways. And if you produce knowledge in different ways and you use different topics, then you are discounted as a producer of knowledge.
Yeah. That's right. That is exactly the downside of the kind of quality control mechanism I mentioned when I teach my students about blind referee. I'm also teaching them about something that excludes other, you know, forms of expression that aren't accepted within that format. There, I think, I mean, I rather hastened over the Southern Theory kind of material, but Shariati himself is very interesting in that respect, because he worked in a university to start with, but was thrown out of the university by the Shahs, by the secret police, actually. He was blacklisted. So he went to work in an Islamic institute in Tehran and made of that a major centre of intellectual life in Tehran, and actually developed, and this is available in English, actually, this stuff has been translated, actually developed a whole agenda for a research centre, a global research centre of Islamic social science, which he never, he didn't live to, he was arrested and thrown into prison and died soon after being released, so he never actually realised this agenda. But he did at least construct a whole programme of knowledge production that had different cultural bases from the westernised university. So there are models for doing this, and quite intellectually impressive models, but you have to go looking for them, because you won't find him on the, you know, on the reading list of almost any sociology department in the world.
Hi, thank you for that. I really enjoyed that. I'm just interested in definitions. Would African intellectuals or intellectuals like Ali Shariati from the colonized world accept your definition of what an intellectual is, or do they have a completely different perception of what an intellectual is?
Yeah. I would imagine that there are, there could be very different ways of formulating what an intellectual is, especially if you're starting from a religious base, as Shariati did, and you would assume knowledge, or at any rate truth, to be associated with God, and therefore the intellectual's relationship with God is formative in the project. That's undoubtedly true. When I was quoting his different model of an intellectual, I should have made that point, actually, that this had a religious component. So that's one kind of difference. Another kind of difference would undoubtedly arise in circumstances where intellectual work involves the articulation of traditional forms of knowledge or their application to new circumstances. And I'm familiar with that in the Australian case, because there are surviving Indigenous cultures in Australia, despite, you know, a genocidal history of colonial settlement. And in those, we can see different formations of knowledge, different relationships with the land, for instance, as part of the social order which has to be represented when you're representing social formations. So again, I would be happy to acknowledge that there are different ways of thinking about intellectuals, and my theorization is that, in a sense, from inside the global, you know, university-based, professionalized knowledge system. It's a kind of auto-critique within that, wanting to acknowledge other possibilities and engage with other possibilities.
Professor Connell, thank you very much for a tremendously fascinating presentation. Two implications of the global metropole and the periphery that you painted for us that I wanted to ask your thoughts on in relation to kind of knowledge generation that I see is, firstly, the question around the ownership of data that's produced in the periphery, and let's say, for example, ownership of data produced in Cape Town in South Africa, and secondly, access to journals and access to publishing. So with regard to the former, I think we sometimes see researchers from the global metropole coming to the periphery and collecting data and then often returning to the global metropole and publishing and often not even acknowledging neither the organisations nor the people themselves who were involved in data collection. Yeah. I think that to some extent reinforces that picture that you're painting. Yeah. So I think my first question to you is, how do we challenge that? How do you, as an academic, and how do we collectively, as people who are interested in kind of intellectual knowledge, challenge and advocate against that? And then in terms of the publishing issue, I think working within an NGO, one of the challenges that we often face is that getting the work that we do and the data that we collect published in journals, whereas academics often have access to that journals but then are faced with the challenges that they have in terms of having to publish within certain journals and often those are the journals that you highlighted in terms of the ISI ranking. So I think the second question challenge to you very quickly would just be kind of how do we build that link between the academic world and the practitioners. Yep. On the ground, if I want to use that word, that you're very much a practitioner yourself, in terms of access, better access to journals. Thank you.
Yeah. The first point you make, the first question you raise is already an inflamed debate about the appropriation, for instance, of indigenous knowledge by drug companies, for instance, who have appropriated indigenous knowledge of healing plants. So there are debates which I'm sure some of the lawyers present will know more about than I do about intellectual property rights and the relationship of indigenous knowledge to the global trade in intellectual property. There is a dilemma, I think, as research technologies in the social sciences at least. But this is also true in some of the natural sciences too. As research technologies have got more elaborate, with more interest in standardised comparative projects, these, for instance, in educational measurement, there's now a lot of work which has applied standardised tests to children in different parts of the world. But there are also comparative projects in sociology, which is a standardised methodology in different parts of the world. As these kinds of things are almost always funded from the global north, either by government or by American corporate funders, it's the intellectuals of the global north who are the gatekeepers for these kinds of things. And if social scientists or natural scientists in the global south want to be part of them, they have to do it on the terms that are set, if you like, by the funders and the initiators of these projects in the global north. So there is a kind of, it's not an easy thing for intellectuals in the global south to negotiate. They can't just turn away from all of that and simply not participate in what is in fact state-of-the-art science. So there's real dilemmas there. And I guess how to respond to it? Well, one of the responses is to talk about it, actually to bring the issue into the light of debate, to talk about the bad cases, the bad practices, to get debate of this on this kind of issue happening in international forums. And once you do that, then I would think international organisations, like disciplinary organisations, the International Sociological Association, for instance, would be interested in its ethics statements in trying to do something about that kind of exploitation in that kind of way. So there are some disciplinary mechanisms, if you like, within the university world which can be mobilised to deal with that. The publication thing is very intractable because those hierarchies of publication are so strongly institutionalised now. But again, even the institutions, even the mechanisms of management can sometimes be used to shift that. So, for instance, if you have a performance management indicator for academics in terms of their output of publications, and you only count publications in refereed international A-star journals, you're going to get one kind of practice resulting. If you regard as a significant form of production, of intellectual production, and a valued form of academic activity, publication in community forums oriented to social movements or local groups who need the knowledge produced by academic research, then you can build that into your management tools and performance indicators and create a kind of pressure the other way. So these are not intractable issues. They are often difficult issues, but they are ones where we can push.
Thank you very much. It was extremely interesting. About nearly 30 years ago, I think we were sitting in this hall, in this room, and the debates and struggles around the role of the intellectuals in the anti-apartheid movement were very heated. We had trade unionists, community-based organizations, and so on. Really, we were really engaged in the discussion about whose knowledge counts, what are our roles, and so on and so on and so forth. So I was just wondering how far the distinction about the center and the periphery, the north and the south, whether one could take that same kind of power dynamic and think about ourselves in the south, but in the university and in broader communities, or in our relationship with social movements, in a way the same imagination that you were talking about, which is about creating a southern theories from the south. Mm-hmm. Is it not a similar kind of thing? Because in a way we as intellectuals in universities based in the south, in the periphery, are colluding in many ways to maintain that power relation. So the same struggles that we are having with our colleagues elsewhere in the world, we are having right in our own backyard. Mm. And I was just wondering how you think about that, because it feels like the questions that have been asked are just resonating with the debates we've been having here. Well, certainly, 30 years and more. Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, you ask how I think about that kind of issue, and I would have to say with great discomfort. it has been an issue that has concerned me all my academic life. And, you know, the history of social struggle in Australia is different from what it is here, but there are enough resonances, if you like, that I can understand very much the point you're making. There are forms of activist knowledge, there are forms of knowledge that are produced by subordinated social groups or marginalised social groups or even the social majority, which are different from the specific forms of knowledge institutionalised in universities. And it's a long and difficult process, and one in which there are setbacks as well as gains, to try to make the, if you like, the social machinery of knowledge production in universities answerable to the needs of a wider community and of social groups who don't usually get access to university. I say there are setbacks in that because I think a number of the mechanisms that I was describing under the head of neoliberalism and global inequalities, that they have actually increased in intensity in recent years, not decreased. I think in some ways social justice projects around knowledge have lost ground, not gained it. And I don't know enough about South Africa to know if that's the kind of judgment you could make here or not. I hope not. But that is, I think that's very relevant. I don't think it is quite the same issue as, you know, global inequalities, but they're undoubtedly linked and they raise, you know, at least overlapping ethical and practical questions about how we do something different.
Thank you. I'd like to firstly appreciate the time that you've taken to articulate this complex issue. I want to add just 2 points and make a short question. One is, African knowledge systems, you know, has an intellectual tradition and a tradition of reading as well, contrary to how it's been portrayed during the colonial period and North Africa, West and Central Africa as well. So it's important, it's not just the knowledge of the oral tradition and poets and all of those. And secondly, I mean, my question is most probably related to the penultimate one, and my second, in terms of the conceptualization of the global South as narrowly geographic, being, you know, the metropole and the periphery. But I think there's a much more complex reproduction of the metropole and the periphery in the in settler contexts, such as Australia and South Africa, Canada and New Zealand as well, and oftentimes Africa is excluded from that comparative study, and South Africa particularly. So that is here, and I'm, as much as you hope that it's not, it is. I mean, you're at an institution that reproduces it as well, I mean, for good and for bad reasons. And my question, I mean, relates to your advocacy of the role of the intellectual in terms of his or her position, you know, in the future, in what faces us, that faces us as a society. I mean, Cape Town is a divided society, and it remains one. It lives its history as well, and the university produces that knowledge. I mean, you just have to look around, you know, and see how we reproduce ourselves as intellectuals sitting inside of these chairs to see that we are a social reflection of this process as well. So my question is, how do you, as an advocate, you know, engaging from the podium in this particular context, engage not only the quality, the control of quality, but also the political control of that knowledge through that quality mechanism of quality control, we are the people who do that as well, and you know, you are with the administrators. How do you manage, and how do you, in that context, advocate, you know, for an institution to move beyond its rhetoric of Afropolitanism or non-racialism, you know, whilst it continues to reproduce in its intellectual institutionality the same political racialization of an economy that's still alive. We all hope for it to be different as well. How do you engage and how do you move that forward bit by bit?
My practice has been to, maintaining a fairly active presence in the university life, also to try to find wider forums where the resources that I or my colleagues have got can be put to a different use than simply the reproduction of privilege. And I've found I've done that in somewhat different forums at different stages of my academic career. There was a time when the Australian Labor Movement was a serious player in terms of changing patterns of social inequality and moving towards some sort of more just society. And at that time, I spent a lot of time working with unions, Labor Party branches, writing for Labor Movement periodicals, doing workshops and so forth, and trying to connect university-based social science with largely working-class audiences on their ground. The Labor Movement has changed. That kind of project is not now currently a very promising one. I've also tried to work in something that way with teachers in schools as another non-university social forum where organised knowledge could make a real difference. So again, I've worked with in-service training, in some school-based curriculum development or social research projects, working with educational policymakers sometimes to push their thinking in more democratic and culturally inclusive ways, and sometimes we seem to have made some ground there. Working with teacher unions, not incidentally, who in Australia are, you know, quite a significant support for progressive educational thought. That's the kind of strategy that I've found useful. Now, whether other people would find those kinds of enterprises doable or promising, and whether that kind of approach would work in another circumstance, I can't say, but that's certainly been a productive thing for me. And also, I've talked a couple of times, mentioned the kind of internal quality control in academic life. But that, for me, has been a kind of quality control over my work as an academic. That is, I felt it important to expose it to criticism, if you like, in a social movement or a social practice context, so that I could learn, you know, how relevant, how meaningful it actually was to a non-academic audience. So, I mean, that's just one person's experience. I'm sure there are many other ways of doing this, but it can be done. Okay.